Hello and welcome to the Open Source Security Podcast, episode 55 with myself, Kurt Seyfried, and my partner in thought crime, Josh Bressers.
Oh man, Kurt, I am so excited. Let's Encrypt finally is going to have wildcard certificates.
Yeah, I'm actually really looking forward to that because I actually started buying wildcard certificates many years ago because it was just simpler, right? You buy one certificate and you're done.
Oh yeah.
Right. Totally. You don't have to get one per host or whatever. And then of course I just outsourced the whole mess to Cloudflare and just walked away from it. It's like, right. It just works. Not like, and for $5 a month, right? So yeah, but I mean, yeah, I love the fact that we'll be able to get wildcard certificates for free.
That's, you know, man, I think about this is I remember certificates. This was back in the day. They were like hundreds of dollars.
Yep.
I mean, it was so expensive and so crazy. Even getting a domain was really expensive and really hard.
I remember when getting a domain was free.
Why? Because it was like in the hosts file, everyone was copying around?
No. Like 20 years ago when you registered a DNS domain name, you didn't have to pay
for certain top-level
domains. They were just free.
That predates me. Everything I've ever dealt with involved money.
Yeah.
So,
or like I knew a guy that got like two portable C-class addresses back in the day and then ended up selling them for some good money. Well, he was running a quote-unquote ISP. It was basically like an ISDN line, like a 128K ISDN line for his internet feed. And then like a bank of, I think it was 14.4 dial-up modems, maybe 9600 baud. I forget. But yeah, and the whole reason he did that is so that he could have free internet at home. Right. And basically, you know, he figured out if he had like 12 or 15 customers, you know, he did the math and it's like he had like five or six dial-in lines. So seriously, like he was only double oversold, which, you know, most ISPs are 10 to 1.
Oh, man. It's I worked at an ISP a long time ago and it was bad. I remember that.
Well, it had to be if you wanted to make money.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably fair. And, like, well, that was part of the beauty of it, though, too, is when you work for the ISP, there's always a couple secret phone numbers, you know, that nobody knows and you can still use to dial up when things get rough. But yeah, I remember those days, man.
Yeah, good times.
Crazy days.
Yeah, so, yeah, this wild, and what I really love, too, is that this, because Let's Encrypt does, you know, they use the ACME certificate protocol, you can basically automate it, and you really will want to, because I think their certificates are, I want to say 90 days.
I think it's 90 days. I use one on my site, and I've automated it, so I don't remember. But
that's part of the beauty of automation. It's like, I've automated it.
Right.
And
right,
we're done.
Right. Now, I will say, though, that it sounds like these wildcard certificates are slightly more work, because for just one host, you pretty much run a script on the host and magic things happen and then you get a certificate. And that's not quite
well, because it does domain validation at the like web server level, right? My understanding is right, because it basically talks to the web server, gets the little validation thing, right?
Yeah.
And then you're done. And it's basically the same. They do validation at the root of the DNS. So like for example for seafree.org, I would run the client, it would connect to Let's Encrypt. Gets a token, you know, basically I say to Let's Encrypt, I want a wild card for seafree.org. They go, okay, here's your token, like your magic little value. And I have to put that magic little value in a text file in my DNS for seafree.org.
A text record.
A TXT
overly
record.
Overly pedantic, of course.
Yes, a TXT record, which is one of the most wonderfully overused and abused DNS records, because there's my SPF records and there's my, all sorts of things. And and then basically on their end, they do a DNS query for your text records, your TXT records, and obviously if the token appears, then, well, basically you control that domain to a point where nothing else they can really do to validate it will matter.
Right, and it sounds like you will need a new token for every renewal.
Yeah.
So this will and definitely need some automation with your registrar.
Every single major DNS provider now has an API.
I would hope so.
Well, no, like Amazon Route 53, Cloudflare, you know, DIN DNS, right? These guys have all had APIs for, well, since the beginning, basically.
Probably. I'm just too
Well, you have to if you have like 100 domains to manage.
I mean, four, which is, I won't lie, it's very manual still. I think they expire soon. I need to log in and check that.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I remember handcrafting hosts or DNS bind, you know, zone files.
Oh man, those were the days.
And I still can, sadly. But by and large, I've, you know, again, outsourced all of that to just, you know, Cloudflare or Amazon or whoever, because quite frankly, like,
yeah,
nope. Yeah, no, I don't want to run multiple servers just to have DNS. Well, and I used to cheat too. In the past, what I realized what I could do is I could actually get away with setting www.cfree.org as one of my DNS servers, and that way that record with that IP address would be in the root zone file.
Oh, look at you.
And actually, that just came up with .io. Somebody realized they could register .io domains. That
story is madness.
Well, it's just sloppy coding, right? Like,
I don't know if it's even coding. It's poor policy. Well,
they need to blacklist.
So the story is, let's explain it first, just for anyone who doesn't know, is there's the .io TLD, and apparently there were a handful of root DNS servers for .io that were unregistered domains, and somebody registered them. And of course, that is very bad in many, many ways. And it sounds like once he reported it, people, they kind of cracked down a bit on them. But fundamentally, if you have root name servers, like, nobody should be able to register those domains, nor should they be unregistered in all seriousness.
Yeah.
Like, they should belong to somebody, and if they don't, pull them out. Do not use those.
It's going to cause performance issues, right? Because you're going to have a lot of clients timing out.
Yeah, that too, because, I mean, essentially, if you have, you know, a dozen root domain servers, the other domain servers, just they try one at random. And if it's not there, they're gonna try somewhere else.
Yeah. But no, I've also encountered DNS providers where you could specify your DNS server, and in some cases you could specify the IP address it was, and they would like add that glue record, and obviously then you could potentially hijack somebody else's domain.
Yep. You know, I've heard that before.
So yeah, all sorts of shenanigans. But yeah, back to the whole let's encrypt thing. I mean, fundamentally, this is not hard to automate, and well, basically, if you've outsourced your DNS in any way, shape, or form, and your provider doesn't give you an API, to put it bluntly, that you need a new provider.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
That's just, well, no, you know, I can't think of a single cloud or even any online service I use now that does not have an API.
APIs are king, man, right?
Yeah.
It's what everybody does.
Right? Like, what's that famous expression? You know, how many, you can control like one computer from a GUI, but if you have like an API or a scripting language, you can control all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Why not?
So, yeah, no, what really gets me though about the whole Let's Encrypt thing is that we're still going to have a CA market because people will just not use it, or they'll be like, oh, Let's Encrypt, it's all whatever made up reason, we're not going to use it, right?
I know. And I'm sure there's going to be various reasons, and there's always going to be those old stodgy people that do things the way they do things because that's the way they do things. And I don't know about compliance because I should research this.
Well, I guess compliance, well, I'm sure you can read it both ways. What happens
with some of these CAs is they get audited by a third party to verify that their infrastructure, they're using like HSMs and they're storing keys properly and they've got, you know, all PII is dealt with in this certain way. And it is conceivable Let's Encrypt can't pass some of those controls, which who cares?
Looks like, wow. If you go to letsencrypt.org/repository, there's a whole bunch of stuff.
What do you mean a bunch of stuff?
They've got ISRG certificate practice statements like every, looks like quarterly?
Oh, okay. Twice a year. So they might be good enough.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Well, and more to the point, that's just it's a problem you can solve with a bit of money. It's not insurmountable. And because there's two CAs being, you know, put to sleep, basically, you know, WoSign and StartCom.
Yes.
What is it? They got 2-3 more months before Chrome boots them.
Yeah, they should have been booted years ago.
In fairness, StartCom was not always terrible, but then the problem is they got bought by WoSign, who they've been caught doing all sorts of shenanigans repeatedly, right? Yes. That's the part that is a problem, right? It's not just that they did one mistake once. They've been caught multiple times, you know, backdating certificate dates, issuing certificates for, like, the wrong people, or pretty obviously, like, malicious certificates for various, you know, large web properties. And then they bought StartCom, so now, you know, the trust is eroded.
That's a really good point, is one of the beauties of having a 90-day expiration time is that even if somebody, say, gets a Google.com wildcard out of Let's Encrypt, which we'll assume they can't, but let's say it does happen, it's only good for 90 days, which, I mean, by the time you mount your attack and actually get things underway, you're probably going to burn at least 30 of those 90 days, you know, just getting ready. Whereas when you're getting some of these other certificates from these registrars that are good for years, that's crazy.
Well, and there is that new, we talked about it a few episodes ago, and I just, the name is escaping me, but it's a DNS record type, CA cert, I think is the record type, where you can basically specify in your DNS zone file what CAs, you know, you're sort of willing to allow.
Yeah, but to do that,
in theory is great, but, well, the thing is, all the certificate authorities have to check for that before they issue a certificate.
It's kind of a mess.
Well, and, well, you could simply make that a requirement. Like, Chrome could say, look, if you don't do that, we're booting you out, and you'd have compliance. You'd have to. Right, and that's kind of one of the things I like about Chrome, and one of the things I also fear a little bit is, you know, Google can use Chrome as a compliance hammer.
They can. That's a good point. And they are, right?
I mean, and same thing with their search results, right? They're going to be ranking HTTPS higher than HTTP now.
Which I'm also okay with.
Well, when you consider all the shenanigans going on with, you know, state-level actors intercepting and modifying web traffic, you know, FinFisher, you know, modifying binaries on the fly to attack human rights activists and Lord knows what else, you know, the reality is you can't do unencrypted network traffic anymore.
No, absolutely not. And this is one of the things that really just... Google is doing this, and I hear various reasons why people think they're doing it, from everything from they don't want their ads modified in flight to just they're great guys to, you know, they're concerned about the data. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, this is going to be a good thing regardless of motives. And so it's probably one of those situations where, you know, maybe the ends do justify the means. You know, who cares how we got here?
Well, for myself, it basically boils down to is I want a secure web browser, right? I really need that. And luckily for me, Google's self-interest, for example, in protecting their ad revenue, happens to align with my need for security. So, cool. You know, I don't, in this case, care so much why they're doing what they're doing. I'm just very happy that we have that confluence of, you know, needs and incentives, you know, so I get my really great free secure web browser, you know. Yeah, you know, I love the fact that they're driving HTTPS, you know. That's a good thing because every time I browse the web on my phone, you know, the ad experience, oh my God, it's freaking terrible.
Goodness, man.
It's unbelievable.
Anytime I use a web browser without an ad blocker, I how do people do that? I cannot understand. I cannot.
Just the speed alone. Holy cow.
That too, man. Know. Just the load time is the ads all load. You'd think if you're an ad provider, you'd have a huge incentive to load the ads extremely fast, right?
Yeah. Well, part of the problem is they have to go through a broker system to like line up, you know, oh, it's Josh looking at, you know, pictures of kitty cats. So we're going to advertise like a puppy to
him. I was wondering what was going to come out there.
You know. I had to go through my Rolodex of safe things. Safe
child
things, kittens.
Friendly.
Kittens are safe. Yeah, I forget, what is the rating on our show? Is it PG or just
we don't have a rating.
Random.
We're not marked explicit.
So. We're unrated, so that's right.
We'll keep it clean.
Yeah,
for the most part, we do.
Yeah, so you know, that kind of leads to another good story this week is the whole Kaspersky thing.
Oh my goodness, that's. I don't even know what to think about this because everything just keeps unraveling in bizarre new ways. And I mean, just.
Well, okay. So for those of you that somehow don't know.
Well, there could be future civilizations listening to us as a way to determine what the past was like.
I'd like to apologize to them.
Right.
Anyway, so Kaspersky antivirus. Well, two things sort of cropped up in the news recently. Number one, the U.S. government has gotten a little bit. How is it put? A senator asked a very pointed question that would tend to indicate that they learned something in an intelligence briefing that they're not actually allowed to talk about openly. And so kind of one of the ways to get around that is to ask a pointed question that sort of like leads people down the path to like discovery of, oh my God, you know, here's this horrible thing. And he basically asked an intelligence official, like, would you allow Kaspersky products to be used on your network? And the answer was like, nope. Well, and I guess the sort of second part of that was the whole U.S., was it the FBI, I think, was basically went to a bunch of U.S. employees for Kaspersky to ask them questions about, like, how much direction do they get from the mothership and, like, what are their, you know, roles and responsibilities and whatnot. And then the second big piece of news is sort of that, well, Kaspersky, you know, works with the FSB, you know, the Russian former KGB
group. Right.
And the reality is, okay, well, that's going to happen to some degree for all these providers, because Kaspersky doesn't just do AV, right? They do also sort of security and threat intelligence, DDoS monitoring and mitigation, right. Well, all that kind of crap.
Nobody just does AV anymore, right? Yeah. They all have this suite of magical products, and I'm using air quotes if you can't tell.
Huge air quotes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, the reality is any, you know, if you run that kind of threat intelligence service, chances are you're either going to be served with warrants for information or, you know, they're going to be doing an investigation and they're going to, you know, want to work with you or vice versa. You stumble onto something horrible and you have a need for, you know, the police to get involved or, well, whatever, you know, level of law enforcement. But, you know, of course, the way it's sort of coming out and the way it looks, it doesn't look that great. And, you know, there's a lot of mistrust right now, obviously. And I have no idea what the facts of the case are. It could be completely legit. Like, they just work with these guys on those specific things. And it's not a case of, like, you know, Putin forcing them to put backdoors in their AV, which are running on 400 million devices. Or, well, you know, okay, but maybe they are for all we know. I have no idea.
The way I look at this is, it is no secret that the intelligence communities pretty much around the world don't necessarily get along, right? There are nods and handshakes with some groups, and there are other groups that pretend they like each other, but fundamentally, their job isn't to get along, right? And I would be very surprised if the FSB has Kaspersky putting in backdoors and things like that. However, even if Kaspersky isn't cooperating willfully, they're in a jurisdiction that's mm-hmm. going to, certain information well, will get to people who want it, we'll say, right?
Well, more to the point, their employees can be coerced
and, right, with relative ease. There's many ways, exactly. There's many ways. And so, I mean, fundamentally, what it comes down to is if you're an intelligence organization, regardless of where you are, you should probably be sticking to security-type products that come from your home country because...
Yeah. Or open-source ones.
Well, yeah, that's fair. I mean, you know, then you can at least inspect and understand.
Yeah.
And even if it's your home country, there's nothing stopping other intelligence organizations from, you know, going to your employees and saying, you know, here's 50 grand, wink, wink, make this happen. It's tough, man.
I've kind of never really... having issued about, I think, 6,000 CVs now, backdoors definitely can be, you know, very hard to find, you know, and exploitable in a way that's, you know, even looks like normal network traffic, right? So that it really is hard to detect. But the reality is, I mean, most of these products have, like, they have security flaws.
Well, they have security flaws, you know, or they have the equivalent of a backdoor that's just like built into the thing as sort of, you know, command and control or phone home. Well,
and AV was pointed out as being particularly terrible for this for two reasons. Number one, it has to touch all the files on your system. End of story. Otherwise, it can't work, right?
Yep.
And number two, it gets updates constantly from whatever mothership, including not just like data updates, but actual... Well, like as Tavis Ormandy pointed out, you know, these things stink for security and they need like lots of updates. You know, so new file types, new unpackers, blah, blah, blah. So like binary components as opposed to just like, you know, if it was just some sort of, you know, data file format, that could be somewhat sort of safe if you had like a trusted binary. But in this case, you know, the binaries are like updating themselves all the time. And so I mean, if somebody, you know, were to compromise an antivirus vendor or, coerce them. Yeah, I mean, they could, you know, just literally add an update and be done with it. I mean, well, and that's, I mean, that's what happened in the Ukraine, seriousness, right?
I don't think, yeah, we'll get to the Ukraine in just a second.
Yeah.
But I think more importantly is, I don't think the threat is necessarily backdoors and malicious updates directly to the organization, right? There's ways to distribute backdoored applications.
Yeah.
But my suspicion is, anytime an intelligence agency has an interest in a certain product, they just want data about customers for their own reasons. And that is, in many instances, a lot of companies would probably just hand that over thinking, eh, what's this going to hurt, right?
Well, you legally would have to hand it over in most cases.
In you know, point.
You've got, right. Even the U.S. has, was it under the Patriot Act, where they could the basically FISA serve
courts, yes.
notices that you weren't allowed to talk about, or even that you had been given one, right? And so people started putting up those warrant canaries and blah, blah, blah.
And even then, I still don't know. Many lawyers and other people I've spoken with, it sounds like they, as part of the FISA request, they can tell you, keep updating the warrant canary, right?
And so, that seems reasonable because honestly, as a judge, if I was a judge, I could... An argument that saying that, like, look, we're going to serve this organization with a warrant and they're going to drop their warrant canary and everybody's going to know we served them with a warrant and we can't have that happening because of these reasons, or, you know what, we just can't tell you, national security, whatever. There's a valid argument to be made there in some cases, right? Now, whether or not it flies, yeah, we have no idea.
I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. Let's talk about the Ukraine, something more exciting.
Yeah, accounting software, which, you know, everybody loves to hate. I guess except for accountants who just generally hate it.
Well, but more bizarrely is it sounds like what 80% of businesses in the Ukraine use the same piece of software.
Yeah, that makes sense because have you ever read the tax code?
Unfortunately,
okay. My accountant once showed me the abridged yearly update of the Canadian tax code, and it was like a phone book.
Yeah, it's enormous. Thick how many things there book are
because... about the size of a novel. And that was the abridged kind of important changes.
Right,
and
that's
the thing with tax software, right? Like nobody's ever going to make open source tax software because nobody is ever going to figure out all those business and tax rules and put them into a computer.
So like, actually, you need a team of accountants to do that. Something interesting I learned a long time ago is I guess in the US, I don't know if this is true everywhere, but the IRS apparently has like a standardized data format that they send to the accounting software companies, and I don't know if it's free or you have to buy it from them, but essentially they found a way to like programmatically explain what the changes are in the tax code, and then obviously these companies
that makes
have
sense, like, because you'd have way less errors because
probably.
I mean, part of it is right is there's always that, you know, well, it's like generally accepted accounting principles. There's a lot of wiggle room, and like, you know, all the companies that do GAAP, they're not generally doing anything even remotely illegal, but holy cow, some of the wiggle room in there.
Oh, yeah. It's,
you know, what some of these companies do is like, wow, you know, I did not know you could deduct pandas.
Right. Like you everything know? You do is, right, the lunchroom is R&D, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly. No, I'm familiar with these. It's,
so, I mean, but anyway, yeah, fundamentally with software, like, I'm not surprised at all in some countries that there's only one or two software providers for this stuff because there's really that. I mean, to maintain this software, you know, I can't even imagine because there's, you know, yearly updates at a minimum or, you know, whenever they pass a new law, that can affect the tax code.
Well, and also,
you know, or the way taxes are held or, you know, wages, right? Because the thing to remember too is accounting software is not just about taxes. Typically, this stuff is also doing your payroll, your accounts receivable.
Well, you think the Ukraine is not a giant market, right? It's not like the U.S. where it's huge, right?
Yeah.
So there probably just isn't room for more than one company to be making the like official tax software of the Ukraine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and like, yeah, in general, it doesn't really translate to any other country because, of course, the tax code is going to be completely different.
Right.
So basically, MeDoc, the accounting software firm, got popped and, you know, sent out a malicious update. And apparently, their whole coding infrastructure and signing infrastructure was just in shambles. And so, yeah, I mean, when you think about it, right, it reminds me of, did you ever hear about those Bloomberg terminals?
I do know about the Bloomberg terminals, which is actually how Bloomberg, the company, makes most of their money.
Yeah. Well, how about you explain it then?
Okay. So the Bloomberg organization, which obviously is involved in Wall Street, and there's what they have a TV station, I think, and there's a magazine, yep. and I think they do some investing. I don't know exactly. Anyway, but the real thing they do is if you are involved in Wall Street, you get these terminals that kind of connect you to the various brokerage houses and various information about what's going on. And yeah, they're just these wacky little boxes that you pay, and we'll say a lot of money for. And then you get yeah. the right to kind of use them for various financial transactions and news. And yeah. it's like a huge deal, right? If you do not have one of these, it either means you're small or dumb. And that's kind of the way.
Well, you basically don't get to play well, in the same playing field as everybody else. So good luck.
Right, right. So what about the Bloomberg terminals, though? What is your story?
Well, so basically somebody was pointing out that these things, you know, they're plunked right into the center of every financial network on the planet.
Yes.
Right? You can't like firewall them up. You can't restrict access to them.
Right.
And they have this like connection back to the mothership, you know, to get the data right. and whatnot.
Well,
and
isn't that what happened to Swift way back in the day? Is there was a bank using like a Netgear router or something?
it was worse than that. It was the, it's even better. They were buying secondhand IT equipment.
Oh, good. Yes, I would.
And so, yeah, I think it was Netgear and some of their printers got popped or were already infected, maybe. I don't remember entirely. But I guess the moral of the story is, regardless of if you buy first-hand or second-hand equipment, but especially if you buy second-hand equipment, you really got to wipe that stuff before you use it.
No, don't buy second-hand equipment.
Well, no, don't. I'm
comfortable saying that. Just kind of in general, even if you're a person.
I think the problem is people forget, like, printers are not printers anymore. Printers are computers with, like, a printer attached to them.
Right. Don't sell your gear and don't buy someone else's gear. I mean, for real.
If you're going to buy firsthand, you have a better chance of getting legitimate stuff that doesn't have like wacky viruses.
We're talking about the Ukraine. So what happened with this accounting software?
So MeDoc, they were the spread of the Petya virus, or not Petya, or whatever that's called. I think it's called Petya ransomware.
Right, whatever. The ransomware thing that's not
ransomware. You know, it was between the MeDoc and what Petya did, it really is beginning to look like, you know, a nation state level attack on the Ukraine.
Probably. You know, and you know what I love though is there are tons of people who are talking about this company didn't sign their software and they weren't distributing correctly.
Yeah,
they weren't doing this and they weren't doing that. And it probably wouldn't have mattered. I won't disagree. But then you know what really got me thinking is, so let's say I'm a small company and I'm writing accounting software. Where am I going to even go to get advice about how to sign and distribute my software?
Microsoft actually has really good documentation on that.
Do they?
Yeah, but seriously. Because I was looking, I actually had that exact question. I'm like, you know, I know how RPM signing works because I've had to do it. the pain. Like, it's not fun. It works, but it's not fun. Getting it, it's one of those classic Linux things where you get it set up and then like, don't touch it.
Right, ever.
Because it will break horribly.
Microsoft actually is really good with this, though. Microsoft having good docs kind of ruins my story a little.
Sorry,
bit. That's okay. That's okay.
No, but fundamentally, you have to know those docs are there, and you have to, you have to read them and then do it correctly.
But here's the thing: is if you're working with an app store, it solves these problems for you, right?
Well, it depends where the signing happens, because fundamentally, here's the thing: signing doesn't really matter if you can just like take over a workstation of a programmer and inject some code in there and they have insufficient code reviews so a great example. Remember we had the core infrastructure guy on talking about security and the best practices and that sort of whole, you know, they've got that whole nice document with the maturity model.
David A. Wheeler.
Yeah. And
yes.
So what was I think it was the first thing there was uses source control because a lot of people still don't.
No, that's a big one.
I'm not talking like uses CVS or some like terrible source control. We're talking like no source control. Like there's a folder shared over Samba or whatever, you know. I've actually seen that, like where a place had a whiteboard to kind of control access. Or
oh, man.
Essentially, the whiteboard was the locking mechanism for the shared folder on the server. They went out of business about a year later, so not super surprising.
Yeah, I'm shocked.
Yeah, you know, source control is tricky. And, I mean, it's not like there's a ton of free tools and services out there.
GitHub.
I'm being sarcastic.
Okay. I'm going to say, I'm like, it's so cheap at this point.
I know. It's ridiculous.
You know what else actually comes up a fair bit is hiding your source code, I don't think is nearly as exciting or interesting as people think it is. Because, I mean, let's face it, no one's really going to steal your stuff. And if they did, they probably still can't build it anyway, because you know your build infrastructure is a disaster.
Yeah, the one thing I've seen where people do consistently sort of need to have their source code secret is all the DevOps people, because they put all their tokens and passwords in there.
That is wrong if they're doing that. There are ways to distribute secrets. And if that's your excuse, that's almost acceptable. But yeah, whatever. I mean,
yeah.
Here's my point, though. Backdooring a developer's workstation is... It's not undoable, but it's difficult. But if you look at the vast majority of attacks up to this point, it has been during the distribution cycle against a lot of software. Because
most of them have such a poor security.
Right. It's not signed, or there's mirrors. I mean, I remember... I don't remember what the last project was that this happened to, but they basically go after mirrors and replace, like the tarball.
Yes. And Handbrake on Mac OS.
Oh, that's right. They just had it. And if people check the checksum, it wouldn't know it checked out, but nobody checks it. So,
yeah.
You know?
Well, it's like every time I get a doc file from somebody, I run it through VirusTotal. And what really shocks me is when I get a doc file from for example, on the CV side of things, MITRE sends out doc files, and I won't get around to reading them for 3 or 4 days, and then I'll run it through VirusTotal and I'm the first one to do it. And that just horrifies me that these people are opening up doc files and trusting their local antivirus, because this is a mailing list. These are just doc files flying around with Lord knows what in them, because it's not like we use some super secure transport mechanism or anything, right? And every time somebody mails me a PDF, right, and I have to open it, I grit my teeth, run it through VirusTotal, and then open it in, Google Docs.
No, man, I get it. Google Docs is where all Word files or presentations or PDFs or literally anything I get go. I love it. It's their problem. I don't have to think about it. It's like, got a virus? Don't care. Google can deal with it. And it's amazing. And... yeah, part of me wonders what kind of garbage they must see on a daily basis. And I bet
bought VirusTotal, remember?
They do own VirusTotal, and it's got to be just horrifying what goes through their systems on a daily basis. I mean, not even on purpose, right? Just people doing.
And this is another argument I have against antivirus, which is antivirus will definitely catch the older stuff and help you maybe with cleanup, but it won't protect you from a targeted or other sort of zero-day attack until you have a signature for it.
Man,
and if it's a targeted attack, you're not going to get a signature for it. And if it's, if you're close to patient zero, I hope those signatures come out in a few minutes or hours, because that's how long these viruses take to spread now.
But here's the thing. Even the old viruses, it doesn't catch.
Oh, by old, I mean like 2 or 3 days old. And, the detection rates for a lot of this stuff were I remember some of them. I think it was 50% or 60%.
It's 20 or 30%, I think, most cases.
Ouch.
And you have to think, at that point, you're probably wasting more money on the software and the lost resources.
Just think of the electricity and CPU cycles. I hate to say it, that's why I got rid of antivirus on my laptop.
Right.
I got back about a half hour of battery life.
At least, maybe more.
Yeah.
It's... yeah, I don't like antivirus. I'm not going to even pretend. I think
antivirus makes sense on file and email servers, but on endpoints, it's kind of too late.
Yes. Yes, it is. Anyway, whatever. Google Docs saves the day. What were you talking about? Ukraine?
fundamentally, you talked about the App Store, and that definitely will, once it gets into the App Store... it's highly, I really, how do I phrase this correctly? A proper app store that does signing, say Google or Apple, is probably very, very safe. I assume they're using HSMs, hardware security modules, and all that jazz. The my understanding is, though, in the Google Android app ecosystem, there are those, like, not Google app stores.
Oh, man. Amazon has one of those. It drives me crazy. It's yeah. Don't use alternative app stores. They're just a bad idea.
Well, sometimes you have to, because my understanding is some of the phone manufacturers, you know, set it up so that you have to use their app store because they want to monetize that stuff and get their cut of the money that. And
I don't know of any phones doing that, but if they are, that's a bad phone manufacturer, and please don't buy their phones. It's just a bad idea. This is where I know Apple gets a lot of guff because they have their devices so locked down. But you know what? I think it's the right thing to do. And I used to not think that, but I totally do.
Yeah. You know, honestly, for non-IT people, what else can we do?
That.
Right? My 6-year-old is what like we my can 6-year-old do. Kids. What are you know, you're going to teach my 6-year-old kids to like choose the App Store safely and somehow, you know, you can't teach a 6-year-old to safely.
Oh my goodness, man. My kids are starting to try to like find their own Minecraft mods and things on their own, and I'm thinking there's no end of this story that doesn't involve their computer getting a virus. Like, that's just the way it's going to be, and I know it is, and I'm going to harp on them and I'm going to do everything, but at the end of the day, like, that's just what's going to happen, and there's nothing I'm can really do about it. I'm really
debating how do I. Because, my one son wants to play Minecraft with mods on a PC. So I'm thinking a virtual machine, but then graphics performance and in general. Like, or do I just image the drive and wipe it?
Suck it up and get the computer. That's what you're going
to
do.
Well, yeah, but no, but I'll have to re-image. Like, I'm thinking I'm just going to re-image it. Yep. Maybe
you're
going
to have to, every now and then, wipe it. That's all you can do, man.
Because just, I haven't used Windows in so long. And I bought those Windows 10 tablets. Oh, lordy. I just, the upgrades. They're so painful and slow.
But at least they get upgrades.
Oh, yeah. Well, to be blunt, that's why I will never buy an Android device. Because, again, in Canada, you know, I can't get an unlocked proper Android device.
Man. There is.
You know, and so I'll get, like, if I'm lucky, like 6 months, maybe a year of updates, and then, oops, like, too bad.
I know, and most people don't care. You know, here's the thing, though, too, is there's all these unpatched Android devices, but nothing's really on fire. Which I suspect has more to do with the App Store ecosystem than anything.
I suspect part of it is most of them don't have enough upstream bandwidth to do anything terribly terrible.
Well, and not only that, the vast majority of people I know who use devices, they aren't like browsing the web, they're running crappy apps.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, in that environment, it's a lot harder to attack that system because, you know, crappy apps aren't going to random websites in many instances.
So, yeah. Well, actually, that's something Apple's locking down is apps that are self-modifying. Like, they have their own built-in update mechanism.
That's awesome.
They're booting that, which I totally, totally love because my kids wanted this one app. And it's a Russian cartoon character called Booba. Remember the one you thought was Nightmare Fuel?
It is Nightmare Fuel.
Anyways, the app is like, it starts and it's like downloading 80 megabytes from some server in Russia. And I'm like, you know, damn it.
Please wait while we configure your accounting software.
Yeah. So, I mean, with Apple totally locking down and owning the ecosystem, on the one hand, as an open source guy, I absolutely abhor and object to it. But on the flip side, what else am I going to do with my 6-year-olds?
I totally get it. And this is, the open source zealot in me is walking a fine line today. And I don't know where it all ends. Because I love that aspect of freedom. But, like, I want freedom for me. I don't want it for my children who are going to download viruses onto their computer, right?
Like, yeah.
Give them a walled garden. Don't let them touch things.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, there's a reason we put fences around playgrounds when they're by a busy road. You know, kids are idiots.
It will be glorious when there are self-driving cars
and
they just don't run over the children anymore.
Yeah. But maybe the kangaroos.
Kangaroos.
Yeah, apparently Volvos don't know what to do with kangaroos, the self-driving Volvos. Really? They're okay with, like, moose and deer and stuff, but apparently kangaroos just confuse them. It's like that, what was it? Those cameras that have the face detection, and they didn't work on dark-skinned people.
Right, because they Because only I guess
in Asia, in like when, yeah, when China. You test them, it's,
right.
or, yeah, well, yeah, China, basically. Because where else are you going to get electronics from anymore?
Right.
Yeah. Oh man, what did I find the other day? It was something electronic and it was old enough that it was actually made in Canada.
It
was really old.
That's amazing.
I forget what it was.
Oh man.
Something we were throwing out.
Right. Should be e-cycle that stuff. You and I live in northern-ish regions of the world, and obviously we get snow in the winter, which is terrible. But Ford is in Michigan, which is also northerny, right?
Yeah.
And I remember I was reading some things that said a lot of these self-driving cars, they were, as soon as they got to kind of the north where we are, and it was wintertime, they started flipping out because they, like all of the testing was happening in Southern California where they don't get snow. They don't like, apparently the one that really got them. They don't
scrape the lane markings off the road every year.
There's that. Well, not only that, I don't know. Do they spray the salt down on the road before it snows where you live?
Oh yeah.
Right.
Or and during, those, right? And you get the oatmeal mush.
They look like white lines if the road is dry, right? Because they spray the salt and now you have like six white lines down the road.
Oh, they don't generally pre-spray. The strategy here generally is when it starts snowing, then they start a little bit of salting and sanding. So you get what we call oatmeal, right? It's where the snow is kind of that mushy brown. It's kind of smushed up with the salt and it's a bit more liquidy and it's got the sand in it. So you actually get somewhat decent traction. The downside being, of course, if it like freezes to the road, you are up the creek.
Well, but the point is, around here now, they spray this stuff on the road.
They pre-spray it. You end up with all these
basically white lines. And the self-driving car is like flipped out because they're like, six white lines, what do I do? You know? And it's...
Just really get over to the right. Yes. I'm pulled over. I can't pull over anymore.
Well, I mean, at least on the plus side, I believe many of these self-driving cars at least just don't... They pull over when something crazy happens.
Well, but here's the thing to remember, right? The thing with the self-driving cars and software is they're going to encounter problems and they're going to fix them. And they will stay fixed. Right. Today, I was driving. I was in the left-hand lane. There was a left-hand turn lane and another, like a right-hand lane. So essentially two lanes going straight and one lane for the left turners.
Right.
This lady in a huge SUV was in the right-hand lane. As it turns out, she was on her phone, I guess, getting directions because she was in the right-hand lane at a red light, started signaling to turn left, and then started pulling into the intersection.
Awesome.
Right? And then there was another car, different light, about 5 minutes later, car from out of province, the advanced green left turn light came on. So basically you have a red light to go straight because both of the oncoming things are getting an advanced left turn.
Right.
You know, so they can basically clear out the left turn lanes. Awesome. And I guess he kind of thought that flashing green arrow meant go.
Sweet.
So he got halfway into the intersection before everybody started honking at him. And luckily the oncoming traffic was like smart enough to be like, oh, there's a car coming through a red light.
He just probably shouldn't turn left there like a doofus.
He stopped and then he actually kind of backed up a bit.
Oh, backed up. Even better.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, it's just if a self-driving car does that, it will make the news and they will fix it.
Yes.
Right? That's the reality. That's the difference between self-driving cars and people. You know, Volvos, oh, they don't know how to deal with kangaroos. Personally, I'm okay with that. I live in Canada. If you ever end up having to deal with a kangaroo while driving, go buy a lottery ticket.
Where did that happen?
Lordy.
It was Austria, I think. So, like, the joke in Austria, because Austria and Australia are sort of similar looking.
Totally the same.
And so the joke in Austria is there are no kangaroos in Austria, right? Because, well, it's a Western, Northern European country.
Yeah.
And actually, it turns out a kangaroo got loose once from the zoo. And so there was a kangaroo in Austria. And, of course, it was huge news, as you can imagine, as a kangaroo in Austria would be. But, it's – however, but this is a really good point, actually. And this is probably a good topic for us to dwell on for a minute and end it because it's a great one. But it's – there are always going to be one-off weird anomalies that happen in any environment, right? Be it self-driving cars, be it your local infrastructure, be it the software you're developing, where like, you know, you've got that case statement with the, you know, if you ever reach here, something terrible has happened. It's like, someday you're going to get there, right? It happens. Yeah. It always happens.
Well, you have an exception handler.
And
just like in software, right? Everything went horribly wrong everything. And somehow your network stack disappeared.
Right. And that's the thing is you have to... I'm not saying you have to necessarily gracefully handle those situations. Well, but I think you need to be prepared for them. And it's kind of one of those.
This is a good question, because what is a safe fail-safe? Right, because for example, like
the situation, right?
Exactly, you know, and what actually really got me as a good argument for AI was there's a really good TED talk on this that we'll add in the show notes. But essentially, they were talking about with AI, like how do you make the AI sort of behave safely and rationally, but not like too much? Because for example, in a self-driving car, you probably want to be able to say like, "Stop, I need to get out." But do you want your like 6-year-old to be able to do that on the highway? Right. So, you know, like the self-driving car maybe needs to take into account things like who's giving me the order, kind of what's the context of this, you know, much like a human would.
Yes.
And anyways, the TED Talk was talking about how one of the solutions they were kind of working on and had found to this was to make the AI uncertain of the problem so that it kind of had to take a more fuzzy approach, kind of like, well, humans, and that they'd actually had some really good success with this. And so, again, you know, people are going to publish papers on this. This, you know, there's going to be questions on what selfdriving.stackoverflow.com or whatever the site is, you know, like, oh, I'm working on a self-driving car, but I'm having a lot of trouble with those, like, you know, those random airline crashes or whatever bizarre meteorites, you know, like any recommendations, you know, and there'll be an answer.
That's horrifying to me to think that there's going to be self-driving forums where people help each other.
I love that everybody thinks, oh, those software programmers, they're professionals and they don't cut and paste code.
Everybody cut and paste code. Doesn't matter who you are. Everybody does it. Everybody does it. I'm not going to even pretend. And I even, man, I did it this weekend. I was working on something. I was trying to prove that a certain thing could be done, right? And this was vaguely work-related. And I didn't know anything about what I was doing. And yeah, I hit a point where I needed PHP to print out the headers that it had received from the browser. You know what I did? I just went to Stack Overflow and typed in PHP print headers, and I literally copy and pasted the first answer I found. I didn't even look at it. I thought, this is fine.
It's like knowing the capital of most countries now. Wikipedia. Right. Here's the question. What's the population of the Ukraine? I didn't know. I looked it up. It's like, what, 43 million or something?
Is it that high? I wouldn't have put it that high.
Anyway. It's a reasonably dense European country. I think for certain things, depending on what you do for a living, it's good to have sort of some general knowledge. But yeah, like a lot of these specifics, yeah, I actively try not to remember certain things now because I know how to look them up. So why would I try and shove that into my brain?
I don't have to try anymore. I just don't. Yeah. Oh, man. Anyway, we were talking about error states and problems.
Yeah.
And this is one of the places, hopefully, AI can get it right. Because if you look at the vast majority of security issues, it's basically mishandled errors, right? And more often than not, that is what happened.
Well, or it was uncertainty in what we sort of meant. You know, like a lot of encryption stuff, a lot of the flaws boil down to, oh, well, now that we've actually built and deployed this and used it and poked at it, now we've learned X, Y, and Z. You know, things like Poodle or Ghost, where it's like, oh, there's these clever-ish attacks. You know, like protocol downgrade. Like, oh, you know, we want two devices to somehow find a compatible protocol to talk. Right? That's a good thing. Well, it turns out that's actually a really tricky problem to get right from a security perspective.
It's
a
terrible idea. And I hate saying that. But
I tend to agree.
It's one of our greatest mistakes.
I think we're too kind to old software.
It's hopefully getting better. But again, this is one of those places that I'm hopeful that kind of some of the AI type things will be able to deal with this, whereas static software cannot.
Yeah, you know, no. I mean, it's yeah. I suspect in 20 or 30 years, software that is not to some degree self-modifying or self-improving, or better yet, working as a collective, like, you know, this web server over here saw this weird condition and figured out how to deal with it, and then it kind of shared that with the rest of the ecosystem. Yeah, I suspect it's like the open source world, right? To me, it's weird that all these poor closed source guys have to, like, reinvent the wheel in-house all the time.
Nobody does that anymore because everybody just uses open source now. I mean, it's open source one, you're using it, whether you know it or not. Actually, Black Duck. We should go over that maybe next time. They just put a report out this week talking about just some of their findings on open source software use, and it's basically what you'd expect. Everyone's using it, no one's updating it, and like everything's terrible. Which, okay,
Well, I like that. I mean, software updating is that's never that's a problem that's never going to go away. It's just an economic issue, right? People also don't update their hardware, their everything, right? Why spend money on stuff that's not broken?
Yes. Yeah. Why spend money on stuff that's not broken? Because we need jobs, Kurt. That's why.
Oh, I think we'll have jobs regardless.
Oh, I know. All right. It's time. Thank you, Kurt. Right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. It's been an enlightening and interesting conversation, as always. If you want any of the show notes for the handful of stories we talked about, you can go to opensourcesecuritypodcast.com. We have links to Twitter and Facebook. You can use the #OSSPodcast hashtag. Let us know what you think. Get a hold of us. And yeah, if nothing else, Kurt, you have a fantastic rest of your day.
You as well. Stay safe, everybody.